I truly desire for my children's children and your children's children to experience a world where they can reach their full genetic potential and celebrate life in the unique way that humans can.
You're listening to the Untaming Podcast.
Rewild the child.
Here is your host, Emily Giles.
Now, as I said in the last episode, with the addition of our newest child, I have decided to end this podcast so I can have more time with my family. This will be the final season. While attachment parenting is one aspect of rewilding, there are many other aspects that I have tried to cover with this podcast. Education, movement, nutrition, physical health, technological influence. Of the 70 plus interviews I've recorded and released, I would guess that I contacted over 200 different people over the past 4 years to come on the podcast. Most of them didn't reply. Some did, but for various reasons, we were not able to schedule a time to record. I'm going to read out some writings from a couple of people who were supposed to come on this season. And then at the end, I will share some of the topics I didn't get to cover and some specialists that I highly recommend. So I am going to share with you some writings now from Sterna Suisa. We had 4 months of back and forth emails, 2 scheduled interview times that failed. So ultimately, I've just decided to read out some of her posts from Instagram. I'll be sharing the links to her website and Instagram account in the show notes. So let's talk about childism. These are things that are said to children and would be weird if said to an adult. For example, how would you feel if someone said, "Have you been a good mother or father today?" How do children feel when they are asked, "Have you been a good boy or a good girl today?" And if someone said to us, "I'm counting till 10, and by the number 10, you better XYZ," it's exactly the same with children. How would we feel if someone asked us, "Can you put on your listening ears?" Or how would we feel if our partner told us before entering a party, "You better behave"? How would a child feel if they are told that? How would we feel if someone told our partner, "Oh wow, your hands are full with your wife or husband"? How do children feel when they are told, "Oh wow, your mother or father's got their hands full"? How would we feel if our partner told us, "You need to share your belongings"? How do our children feel when they're told, "You need to share your belongings"? And, you know, if our partner told us, "Go apologize," same thing for our children. Or go give a kiss and a hug to XYZ. When we treat children as human beings, our language shifts. We need to ask ourselves, would I say this to an adult? How would I feel if someone said this to me? Now, things that are encouraged to be done to children and would be wrong if done to an adult. For example, invalidating, ignoring, and disregarding another person's feelings. With children, we call this sleep training or cry it out. With adults, we call this emotional neglect. Temporarily confined to a space alone against your will after doing something unacceptable. With children, we call this time out. With adults, we call this solitary confinement. When a person physically hurts another person with their physical force. With children, we call this spanking. With adults, we call this physical abuse. You know, we need to ask ourselves, would I do this to an adult? How would I feel if someone did this to me? Why are things in society encouraged to be done to children that are wrong when done to adults? Now, rudeness. Is our child rude when they say no? Or do we have the belief it's rude because we weren't allowed to say no as a child? Is our child rude when they question authority? Or do we have the belief it's rude because we weren't allowed to question authority as a child? Is our child rude when they say that they don't want to share their items? Or when they share that they don't like something? Or do we have the belief that that's rude because we wouldn't dare say we don't like something as a child out of fear? Is our child rude for not giving a hug and kiss to an adult who wants to hug and kiss them? Or do we have the belief it's rude because we were forced to hug and kiss the adults as a child? Is our child rude for not saying sorry in the moment? Or do we have the belief it's rude because we were forced to give empty apologies in the moment as a child? We might feel like shutting down our children's boundaries because our boundaries were shut down when we were children. Instead of shutting them down, we can question our beliefs and expand our own self to welcome our children's boundaries that are not rude. Is our child truly rude, or do we have beliefs that need to be questioned? Is our child rude for setting their own personal boundaries? This one is things children learn through punishments and rewards. To be competitive with each other and try to be the one to get the reward. Those that get punished are inferior and those that get rewarded are superior, which creates a division. That behaviours are to be judged and categorised as either good or bad, when really they are ways we communicate. They learn to lie and hide things that are punishable and only show the things that are worthy of being rewarded. They learn to punish whoever doesn't listen to them and reward whoever they feel is listening to them. This creates a sense of entitlement where they have this belief that everyone must listen to them. They learn to become robots, doing as they are told rather than developing their own unique sense of self. They miss out on learning how to be in a loving relationship where the communication of thoughts and feelings are valued and discussed. They learn that they aren't worthy of receiving any gifts as is. They need to earn things. So punishments don't help our child. Here's what can help instead. Love, especially when our child messes up, is helpful. So for example, I love you. We all have moments where we wish we had handled things differently, myself included. Or, I see how hard this is for you right now. Can I give you a hug? Listening to our child without assuming things and trying to understand them is helpful. I saw XYZ, can you tell me more? Or, I really want to understand you, can we discuss XYZ, please? Showing our child that we see the good within them and that we know they were trying to navigate the tricky situation they were in as best as possible helps. For example, I know you didn't want to hurt anyone, that was a tricky situation. And age-appropriate boundaries help, like, I see you want to play with water. Let's take this to the bathtub where you can continue playing so that no one slips here. Or we're going to put back all these toys before taking out another box of toys. Modeling healthy ways of going about our own challenges helps. Like, I'm having a really hard time right now. Let me take some deep breaths. Or I need a moment to myself. My body needs a break. Connection through humor, play, and fun helps. Like, I want to play with you. What do you want to do together? Or, let's put some music on. Want to choose a song? A secure attachment where a child knows that nothing they do or don't do will ever threaten the relationship they have with us helps. For example, I love you. Nothing you do and don't do will ever change my love for you. Natural consequences that we don't impose help our children learn. Like, how upsetting, your brother told you he doesn't want to play with you now. After the child kept pushing his brother. Or, oh, you don't like the feeling of being wet? After child refuses to use an umbrella. In terms of boundaries, you could say something like, I'm going to take this from your hand. I can't let you hurt anyone. When it comes to our children hurting each other, it's our responsibility to not allow it to take place. Now, this one is about praise. Praising a child is a tricky thing to do because we never know what we are praising. Are we praising the outcome only and showing our child that the process doesn't count? Are we praising our child for giving up their own needs to please and focus only on the needs of others? Are we praising our child for pretending to be okay when they are not okay? Are we praising our child for acting like an adult when they are supposed to be acting their own age? Are we praising only actions that are visible to us, showing our child that simply existing as them isn't praiseworthy? Are we praising blind obedience? Are we praising a child who is persevering when they truly want to quit something that doesn't bring them any joy? Are we praising our child when things only please us and make it all about us, taking them away from their own inner self? Instead of praising, we can state what we notice, like, I see you trying to figure out this puzzle, or I saw you fell off your scooter and got back up, or I saw you swim across the pool. How did that feel for you? So many children are being praised by being told, you are such a good girl, good boy, and good job, and I'm so proud of you. While the child is suppressing their wants, desires, thoughts, opinions, and emotions, is that really praiseworthy? This one is about manners. So in an attempt to teach our children manners, are we lacking manners towards them? Picture this. A child doesn't say please or thank you. Suddenly they are told to say please or thank you. Is that having good manners towards our child? Is it polite to tell another individual to tell us please or thank you? What exactly are we doing here when trying to teach a child manners? Another thing that is commonly done is withholding an item until the child says please or thank you. And how is that being well-mannered towards our own child? Firstly, the same way an infant learns small words here and there from listening to us communicate to them, they learn manners when we have them towards them. Slowly our kids express bigger sentences, and slowly over time they will start integrating please, thank you. This doesn't take place overnight, and this doesn't take place when putting pressure on a child. We need to trust in the power of modelling. Saying please or thank you to our child is how children learn how to address others with manners. We can also say please or thank you when responding to their requests. So for example, a child screams water when they want some water. We can respond, I see you would like some water, please. While we provide them with water, we don't withhold the water or make them say please or thank you in order to get the water. And let's not get stuck on these words, please or thank you. Having manners towards another is more than just words. It's the way we communicate to them through our tone of voice and intention. A child can scream out please in a harsh way, so trying to get a child to say empty words just to be polite might not truly be polite. It's not about saying empty words, it's about truly having the desire to treat everyone around us with kindness and appreciation. Trust in the process. And along these same lines is apologies and forced apologies. You know, forcing a child to apologize may backfire. When we force one of our kids to apologize to their sibling, it might make the situation even worse because it is not a genuine apology and they were forced into it. Who wants a forced apology? It also takes away the opportunity for our child to truly come up with their own genuine way of repairing their actions. Instead, we come in and decide for them how to make amends. This then creates a cycle where a child calls out an empty sorry and then believes they have done what is needed to repair the situation with their sibling. The one receiving the empty sorry gets even more hurt, and the cycle continues where resentment builds up. We might be forcing our children to apologize because we are so uncomfortable with their emotional reactions and pain. When the hurt child receives a sorry, we might even tell them, why are you still hurt? Your brother or sister said sorry. The word sorry doesn't magically remove another person's pain. We might be forcing our children to apologize because we want them to have empathy for others. Empathy is not something we can force on another. We can't make our children feel a certain way for another person. We can bring children to have empathy for another when we have empathy towards them. We might be forcing our children to apologize because we are so embarrassed by what others around us will think of our parenting. Our child is not a reflection of our parenting. Our actions are a reflection of our parenting. We can at these moments look after the hurt child and offer some empathy instead of forcing our child into this. There is no urgency for a child to apologize right away in the very moment, as much as we would like that to happen. Children need the time to regulate their emotions and process what took place. An apology is a lot more than saying the words sorry. It's about listening to how the other person felt, understanding our needs and the reason we did what we did, and problem-solving ways to go about such a situation differently next time. Instead of overpowering our children and telling them what to do, we want to empower them to come to their own realizations and genuine actions. So here are some ideas of what to say to empower a child to repair a situation. Obviously, these are best discussed when everyone has calmed down. So, I wonder how they felt when, or I wonder how you would feel if this happened to you. How would that feel? Or I know you were feeling furious, and I also know that you didn't want to hurt your brother. I wonder what you are going to do next about this. Or do you want to ask your sister how they felt when their tower got knocked down? Or I know you didn't want to throw my papers everywhere, and now papers are everywhere. What do you think we can do about this now? When we try to force our child to have empathy, we lack empathy towards them. Now this one is about time out. So time out teaches our child that they are too much for us to handle, that they can't be themselves with us, that they are unloved when they need love the most, that it's all about how we feel and not how they feel, to send whoever they aren't pleased with away, to feel humiliated and shamed for being, quote, unquote, bad, that it's normal when someone shuts them down or sends them away, that they are on their own when they need someone the most, that we assume they have bad intentions. Contrary to popular beliefs, a child doesn't think over what they've done in time out. Feeling unloved, lonely, and shame never helps anyone think logically over what we've done. We need to do the exact opposite of time out. We need to stay present. Show our child we are capable of handling whatever comes our way. That they are never alone with their struggles. That we know they are doing their best. That we love them, especially when they're having a hard time. Now, this one is about privileges. There's no such thing as losing privileges in our home. I'll just reiterate that these are Stirner's words. I strongly believe that everything I provide my child with during their childhood is their right to have and my responsibility to provide. Especially anything fun and playful, it is a child's right to have access to fun and experience play, not some sort of reward or privilege for behaving a certain way. Reality is that offering our children privileges might make us feel good as a parent. However, privileges feel punitive in a child's perspective. A child knows that if they aren't behaving or doing a certain thing that is requested of them, then they may lose out on their privileges, meaning the privilege is taken away from them and so it becomes a punishment. Now here are some reasons our teen or a child of any age may not communicate things with us. When they were young, we sent them into timeouts. This may have taught them that they are on their own, especially when experiencing something challenging. We give punishments or impose consequences in our home. This doesn't allow a child to share openly all struggles, mistakes, and challenges because they fear getting a punishment. When they were young, we made them feel that they are the ones responsible for our emotional reactions. This may have taught our child to not share everything just in case it triggers us. When they were young, we shut them down every time they whined, talked to us with attitude, or expressed themselves in ways that we feel were disrespectful. This may have taught them to not share things with us because it's never expressed in a good enough manner. When they were young, they heard us repeating a lot of things they told us in confidence to our family members and friends without asking their consent first. This taught them that whatever they share with us will be repeated to others. When they were young, they heard us talking about other individuals in a judgmental way. This taught them that we might judge them as well. We didn't take their childhood experiences seriously when it involved things we felt were petty, like a small Lego or a baby doll, etc. This taught them that we don't take their experiences seriously and so they don't want to share any of it with us. We've never repaired painful incidents that took place when they were younger. They feel hurt in our relationship due to being yelled at, blamed, shamed, and criticized in childhood and never being apologized to. Essentially, they don't feel safe discussing things with us. You know, when they were young, we would shut down their emotional outbursts by telling them to stop crying and there's nothing to cry about. This taught them that we aren't capable of holding space for their emotional experiences. So really, can we blame them? It is so understandable. When people say teens are so hard, the truth is it's all about the foundation in our relationship. And when there's disconnection, we can always work on repairing. Keeping an open line of communication is so important. If we want our child to be open with us, they need to feel safe with us. This one is, how is a child supposed to recognize red flags in relationships when they have been normalized in their home? Stonewalling. When silent treatment is given to a child during arguments, they may feel that this is completely normal to experience in loving relationships. Love bombing. When a child is given an overload of love affection, attention, compliments, and gifts in order to get them to do something. They may feel that this is completely normal to experience in loving relationships. Gaslighting, when a child is emotionally abused by being manipulated to question themselves and doubt their own thoughts, memories, reality, and experiences, they may feel that this is completely normal to experience in loving relationships. Ghosting, when a child is faced with parental rejection, where their parent suddenly and without any explanation disappears. Once again, they may feel that this is completely normal to experience in loving relationships. Guilting and shaming, when a child is constantly told, after all I did for you and I sacrificed my life for you, and made to feel that they owe their life back for all that was done for them. When a child is constantly criticized and told things such as, you are lazy or you are so clumsy, they may feel that this is completely normal to experience in loving relationships. The words we use with our children matter. If by mistake we use hurtful words, it's important to repair the situation with our child. The first loving relationship a child has in their life is with their parent. This then becomes the blueprint for all their loving relationships. We show our children what is normal to experience in a loving relationship through the relationship they have with us. Perhaps the reason teens isolate themselves when they're overwhelmed instead of coming to us with their problems is because when they're toddlers, we isolate them when they're overwhelmed instead of helping them with their problems. When our kids are small and trying to manage emotions, they can't express what they are feeling. They throw tantrums, they throw things, they have meltdowns, they scream and they whine. This is their way of communicating with us. They need help to organize, process, and express their feelings in a healthy way. And society tells us we should punish them for this. Send them to their room, put them in time out. We teach them and train them to not show their emotions. Don't whine, don't complain, your feelings are wrong. Be quiet. Eventually, they stop expressing their emotions to us because we told them over and over again we didn't want to hear it. For so long, they needed to deal with it alone. Alone in their room, their chair, their corner. And then they turn into teenagers and we expect them to feel safe talking to us. We expect them to know that now it's okay. They are subconsciously wired to think the opposite because this is what they grow up learning. Give your child permission to feel. Let them know their feelings are valid and that you care, no matter how small. Make sure they know that they are heard. Pretty soon, meltdowns over crayons will turn into breakups, heartbreak, or even depression. You want your child to know that you will always hear them, no matter how small. You are their safe space. You know, the more we try to control, the more our children may want to break free. The more we rush our children, the longer it may take. The more we demand respect, the less our children may respect us. The more we push our children to feel happy, the longer they may stay with their sadness. The more we keep things taboo and hidden, the more our children may feel intrigued to explore such topics. The more we restrict, the more of a hype we may be creating. The more we push our children to do things on their own, the more they may resist trying to do things on their own. The more we threaten to leave a location when our child misbehaves, the more our children may resist leaving locations in general because leaving has become a punishment. The more we use screen time as a privilege for good behaviours, the more our children may resist ending time with it in general because they may feel like they aren't deserving of it any longer. The more we use threats and punishments surrounding our children's bedroom, example, telling a child they will go to bed earlier due to bad behaviour or sending a child to their room for a time out, the more our children may resist bedtime because it feels like a punishment. You know, our child's body is wise. We need to let it take control. There's no need to force our kids to put on their shoes. Their feet are designed to sense the sensation of the ground and need shoes when feeling the need for protection. There's no need to force our kids to put on or remove warm layers such as sweaters and jackets. Their body is designed to feel hot, warm, or cold. There's no need to tell a child to be careful when they face a tricky situation. Their body is designed to have spatial awareness and can sense discomfort when things feel tricky to them. There's no need to try to force our child to feel a certain way. Their body is designed to feel emotions that may provide them with some guidance. There's no need to force our child to eat a certain amount of food. Their body is designed to feel their hunger cues. We've got to be willing to trust in the wisdom that our child's body has. And this is something that Sterna wrote herself, her own experience. Yesterday, my two kids and I went to the grocery store. At the checkout, as we were emptying everything out of the cart, here's what the cashier told my kids. "You are such a good boy," to my son, "and you are such a good girl," to my daughter. "You are such good kids for helping your mum." To which I responded, "They are good when they help, and when they don't help. When they scream and when they are quiet, when they cry and when they laugh. Nothing can change their inner goodness." We smiled at each other and she answered me, "True." I'm grateful my kids overheard our conversation. You see, we are taught that doing and helping others is the good thing to do. The more a child helps, the more the child may get praised and loved. Yes, helping others is a wonderful thing to do. However, not when it comes at the expense of one's well-being. There's so much focus on teaching children to do for others, listen to others, help others. What about their own self? It actually feels wonderful to help another person. We are wired to connect with others through being of service in whatever way we can. When we can't help another person, it's not because we aren't good. It's because we have other needs and we need to listen to what our body is telling us in these moments. Now, this is just a selection of many, many of Sterna's posts. So, like I said, I'll be putting links to her social media pages and website in the show notes if you want to read more of these. Some more things I'm going to read out now are from Arthur Haynes's book. Arthur Haynes, you may remember, the second episode of this podcast was an interview with Arthur Haynes, and he agreed to come back this season, but very sadly his wife died suddenly and unexpectedly. So of course, we did not continue with our interview, so instead I'm reading out a few excerpts from his book, A New Path. I could have essentially read out his entire book. There's so much in here. This is actually a good summation for my overall goal of this podcast. I truly desire for my children's children and your children's children to experience a world where they can reach their full genetic potential and celebrate life in the unique way that humans can. We must deal with the biggest misconception concerning rewilding. Many envision the only way to remedy the tremendous nature divorcement that humans are currently experiencing is for everyone to return to a hunter-gatherer lifestyle and forego all modern technology. But this is not possible in a world with fragmented landscapes and nature-divorced humans. Where we are all heading on this course is different for everyone, in large part because each landscape is unique and requires different solutions for a truly sustainable and healthy living. Given that it has taken many generations to reach the current point of poor health and maladaption we find ourselves experiencing, rewilding is an intergenerational path that will require multiple birth and death cycles to find our way back to a version of ecocentric living. In other words, it is likely to be our unborn descendants who will realize the ultimate goals of rewilding. Humans who consider themselves part of the ecology of this planet and live with this as a guiding principle. Yeah, this section I'm reading is about free electrons. Anytime someone sits, walks, runs, or plays on the ground, they have the ability to absorb free electrons from the Earth. The planet we live upon is actually a mega donor of free electrons. When we walk on sand, gravel, stone, or even lawns and other vegetated surfaces, electrons can be donated to the human body so long as there is nothing that prevents conduction, such as shoes with rubber or polymer soles, wooden floors, and foam pads. Walking on a wet surface, such as wet beach sand or a field that is damp with dew, improves the conduction and allows more extensive earthing to occur. Now, I don't think I've actually read out what free electrons are or what they do. Arthur spends about 2 or 3 pages going into the whole science behind grounding and earthing. But I'll just basically sum it up with this, which is that preliminary research demonstrates that direct contact with the planet has a number of healing qualities for Homo sapiens and likely other life as well. These including speeding wound healing, promoting better sleep, reducing oxidative damage, lowering blood pressure, suppressing inflammation, and improving various cardiac health issues. I would have loved to have gone far more into depth with three electrons and grounding, but that is a topic for you to look into a bit further if you are interested. Now, this section is titled Naked is Our Natural State. You know, living in cities and towns within our homes, swaddled in clothes, enveloped in our modern worldviews, we're protected from the wild by layer upon layer of technology and domestication, all of which, we are told, is necessary to prevent the loss of our civility and halt the degradation into something more akin to a wild animal. Our pervasive use of clothing now has certainly made it more difficult for us to receive the elemental foods our bodies need, such as sunlight and contact with the ground. It also makes it difficult for us to use the largest sensory organ in our body, our skin, because it is covered with fabric and dulled to the sensations found in the world. In industrialized countries, nudity is so often associated with sex that a suggestion we should expose more of our body to the environment might be interpreted as erotic or perverted, depending on the situation. Even if people could look past this and realize that nudity doesn't necessarily imply either of those things, we would need to contend with the fact that we have also been trained since childhood to be modest and fully dressed. Our modern societies equate clothed bodies with civilized behavior, and to go nude is to be uncivilized. Clothing is a remarkable adaptation to the environmental challenges faced by humans. The advancement in early clothing, such as hide tanning and the invention of sewing, allowed Homo sapiens to move into cold environments and make use of extreme habitats that our bodies could not have endured without this protection. But clothing for domesticated people is more than just protection against extreme cold, intense sunlight, precipitation, or plants armed with prickles and thorns. It is likely that our shyness and cultural modesty will be the biggest obstacle for some to overcome concerning nudity in the outdoors. Even when they are completely alone, many people are embarrassed of their physical form, which is a learned behavior. Young children, regardless of their height, weight, or shape, are comfortable running, playing, and just being nude. Now, Arthur writes, "Nude sunbathing is a practice I use throughout the year when temperatures allow this activity. It exposes the maximum amount of skin to the sun so that my body can efficiently manufacture vitamin D3 sulfate and cholesterol sulfate. But there are many other benefits. It removes restrictive clothing. A good example is women's bras that impede the flow of lymph and can elevate the risk of certain cancers. It allows one to use their skin as an effective sensory array when walking through the forest and other wild areas. It also generates self-confidence and reduces stress, thereby helping the body limit the detrimental effects of stress, e.g. hypertension, inflammation." This next aspect may be quite controversial, as it is about religion. Arthur writes that contemporary belief systems contribute to various ideas that allow for ecocide and potentially interfere with a person's development into a more natural being. Modern religions actually stand in the way of rewilding in a society's transition to a more ecocentric worldview. He's written several reasons for this, because they are contrary to an egalitarian, eco-centered, empathetic society that would value all of the planet's life equally. So he says that it promotes division. You know, a religion that one chooses erects an additional classification system that is used to distinguish different people over and above the other ways we already classify humans, you know, like gender, age, ethnicity, country of origin, all of that sort of thing. So promoting division, it furthers a human-centered worldview. This human-centered worldview often is taken to the extreme, with the deities or single god having human-like qualities or even human-like form. Humans are sometimes considered to be the only organisms to have spirit and an afterlife when the body has ceased living. In this way, the religions afford special privileges to humans that are not afforded to other than human persons. This human-centered worldview actually allows for and promotes egocentric actions, where things such as massive forest clearing and widespread pollution of rivers are not seen for what they are, i.e. ecocide, the extermination of other life on Earth. Ultimately, these practices come back to harm us with sickness and disease. Without any empathy for the rest of the creation, we will destroy the very thing that gives us health in the first place, the natural world. Another point of his is that it reduces the spirit content of the world. For example, if you were a person who believes that the mountain near your home is a powerful entity that houses one or more deities that your religion recognizes, you will interact with that mountain very differently than a person who lives in a society that treats a mountain as an inanimate entity that houses nothing of value save for the metal ore contained within it. Another point is that it endorses hierarchy. Some of his points for this are that a religion without hierarchy would simply mean that people directly interact with creation. As some religions do not emphasize a quality of life on this earth, but instead focus on reaching the afterlife where everything will be made right. We do not have to believe that all of life is instilled with spirit, to treat creation with respect. Call it something different if you'd like, just realize that all life is animated and connected to each other by something very special. In doing so, we create the highest quality of life for all living beings. We can change the way civilization operates because it is in the best interest of our children and their children. So that was just a summary of, I think he wrote 5 pages on how religion stands in the way of rewilding. Okay, this next one is on gender equality. Most modern societies today would be defined as patriarchal, where men generally have a greater authority within the family and within the society. So I'm just going to read out a couple of different points that I've highlighted rather than read everything he wrote. Many male roles are regarded with greater prestige than female roles. One of the more striking examples of patriarchy regards household chores. Women do more unpaid work than men, and men get to have more leisure time than women in most households. One of the more striking examples of patriarchy regards household chores. Even though both genders may be working full-time jobs, it is the female who is expected to do the bulk of the domestic labour, such as cooking, washing, dishes and clothes, cleaning, childcare. These are viewed as traditionally feminine roles, and men rarely share an even burden in this kind of work. What this means is that women do more unpaid work than men, and men get to have more leisure time than women in most households. While feminism has brought more discussion to important women's issues, it suffers from one very significant shortcoming. It is attempting to create equality in a system where equality can never be achieved for any gender. Some forms of feminism would seek to put more women in elite places of power based on wealth, political influence, and religious authority. However, with more women in leading roles, this means that some women will sit above others of their gender and of the other gender on the hierarchical ladder of society. In doing this, it actually creates inequality because some women will have more wealth and social privilege than other women. You know, this is not equality, it is merely men and women sharing the same level of social dysfunction. Historically, we see that feminism has had some unintended outcomes as a result of wanting equality with men, many of whom have pathologically adolescent egos as a result of being raised in a society that has forgotten how to nurture whole humans who understand service beyond self. Most hunter-gatherer groups that have been observed demonstrated high equality between the two genders. This was described as separate but equal. The two sexes often achieved a high level of skill in their respective tasks, performing them at a greater degree of competency than the other gender. Sometimes both males and females participated in a particular activity, but then the methods used were frequently different. So it is clear that modern societies are quite patriarchal and, despite efforts for equality, have simply not achieved that goal. While feminism would state we should empower one gender, which essentially accomplishes the same level of egocentric pursuit in both genders. Egalitarianism accomplishes equality by depowering both genders. It states that all community roles are valuable and that no one deserves greater privilege. While someone's talents can be deeply appreciated, that skilled person, be it a healer, a weaver, or a hunter, is not allowed to sing their own praises, nor do they need to, because they are emotionally well and they do not require constant attention. Arrogance and bragging are common features in modern society, whether it be among individuals, professionals, or politicians. Getting others' attention is a common activity in young children, and when this behavioural trait continues into adulthood, it is a clear indication of a society's failure to create whole humans. Those seeking employment and in politicians must boast of their talents to demonstrate why they are the ones who should be chosen for a particular job or political office, respectively, because they are part of a highly competitive society that does not cooperate for a common goal. Compounding this problem is the fact that many female roles have been devalued by members of society, including by women themselves. For example, food preparation, making clothing, basket weaving, craft work. Domesticated humans often accord the highest prestige to the highest earning professions. Professions that, in many cases, can be quite harmful to the world and even promote inequality among people. To provide for your family through crafting with your own hands, from raw materials sourced from your local area, is today seen as a major setback, true for men and women. This speaks enormously about such a society. Being able to do for yourself is going backwards, whereas forward progression is having someone else do your work. And in the progress, you forget how the task is done. The indigenous model was essentially equal respect for dissimilar jobs done at different proficiencies by the different genders. And Arthur writes, I encourage anyone who wants to hunt to do so, but if everyone in the community does this, the group won't last long because there are many other roles that need to be filled for a community to survive. And while childcare did fall disproportionately to women for a number of reasons, including the ability to breastfeed, and often the distances travelled during hunting precluded young people with short legs from participating, that shouldn't be taken as women get the lower prestige role, which is often the interpretation in a society where women want to emulate men in their pursuit of material gain. Isn't nurturing the next generation of providers, healers, educators, role models, protectors and elders the most important role in any community? This next section is on rites of passage. Ceremonies are used to mark the passage of important milestones in people's lives, including birth, maturation, joining of partners, moving into new roles, and death. Ceremonies contain important elements that do more than simply unite members of the community, though this is a key feature of a communal ritual. Ceremonies also can provide recognition for accomplishment, help provide guidance for people as they move into a new phase of life and connect people to their landscapes. Of course, some are primarily celebratory and allow people the occasion to enjoy a gathering of fellow community members and perhaps distant friends and family with music, food and dance. Modern societies, while still possessing many rituals, have often sterilized their versions of ceremony, so there is little mention of a connection to our ancestors, the landscape, or the energy that animates life. As such, they are more a celebration that focuses on enjoyment rather than significance. Many rites of passage are now transformed to become another opportunity to further material gain. The birthday custom here in the United States is an excellent example of a ceremony that has retained only part of its original significance and establishes from an early age that accumulating wealth is a valid manner of marking a person's journey through life. The birthday party is an extremely superficial way of honoring the maturation of the child or young adult without an acknowledgement, guidance, and expectation. Today's young adults in affluent countries experience greater frequency of identity crises, something that is virtually absent in observed hunter-gatherer groups. While some religious institutions do a better job at retaining important features of ceremony, many ceremonies are simply without the impact found in Indigenous and traditional cultures. Considering that true rites of passage are found in healthy cultures where depression and greed are rare, and that the most powerful, read influential countries of the world, have largely lost these rights, it stands to reason that a return to participation in this universal aspect of healthy community may have a place in healing, to a degree, some of the social pain so commonly witnessed today. You know, the expression of responsibility outlines the individual's role in the coming years of life. This is important for several reasons. For adolescents, it doesn't leave them to figure out how to navigate maturation, which could mean they find harmful associations and become involved in negative pursuits to prove their entry into adulthood. The community expresses the needs they have for the individual in general terms. This is not meant to dictate exactly how the individual is to spend the rest of their life. And further, the community recognizes that with the coming into a new level of maturation, the individual can benefit the community, which is an additional layer of respect added to the person by the group, increasing the person's feelings of self-worth, their perception of being needed, and identity within the community. Now, this final section that I'm reading out from Arthur is titled "The Loss of the Elder and Rise of the Younger." In Indigenous and traditional communities, the elder was a vitally important role. Elders had accumulated a lifetime of experiences and held a vast amount of knowledge concerning living in that place. This knowledge went beyond how to gather this or craft that, but included the traditions, the ceremonies, the history, the methods of problem resolution, and the core values of the community. To be without elders was similar to being without mothers or hunters or healers, because they not only held important information, but also were responsible for transmitting that information through various teaching methods, e.g. storytelling, song, ritual, informal education. The role of elder was necessary to the healthy functioning of a community. Human technology, the sum total of our skills and methods, which is embedded in and demonstrated by our crafts and devices, has generally progressed in a relatively slow manner with little change occurring over a generation. While certain tools and techniques were ultimately abandoned as new ones were developed, most of these technological advances did not cause rapid desertion of methodologies used over a person's lifetime. Therefore, people were able to keep pace with technological change. This also means that the older members of a community, i.e. the elders, were valuable because their life experiences were rich with an understanding of the technology being used by the next generation. As such, they could guide the process of learning the technology of that place. Today, the situation is quite different. Some technologies are changing so fast that within a single person's lifetime, objects may have been invented, used extensively, and then become obsolete. For some items, they may still exist but have undergone so many renovations and overhauls that the original users of the invention may not even recognize the device any longer, and certainly don't know how to operate the new form of the technology. The elders, on the surface, have been transformed into olders. They are just more aged forms of young people. Olders are considered to be less valuable humans that are tucked away in homes and other locations where they are out of sight and out of mind. And in fairness to this title, many olders have spent their lives in wage slavery, in the pursuit of material gain, never bothering to learn and engage in healthy community and healing practices. Compared with the elders of Indigenous communities, they may have less to offer the young people. Elders who can recite years of baseball statistics and talk of actors and actresses of times long gone are not what the world most needs at this moment. We need elders who have immersed themselves in more holistic understanding of nature, one that does not separate the secular and the sacred. It is essential that we have elders who truly grasp that all things are connected, and actions taken now influence positively or negatively humans and other than human persons who are not yet born. These are important aspects of living that transcend technology. No matter what the current music fad or the latest video game of interest, youngers will have every reason to admire elders, when elders hold wisdom that restores empathy in people and rejuvenates the land. When we have had a resurgence of such elders, youngers will respect them, not because they are told to, but because they understand that the elders have their best intentions in mind. Now I'm going to list a few people that I would have loved to have interviewed, but never had the opportunity to. So highly, highly recommend you maybe doing a Google search and finding their books or other interviews they've done or their social media pages to follow. So there is Dr. Stephen Lin. He wrote The Dental Diet. He's almost like a modern day Weston Price. Ben Hewitt. His topic would have been unschooling and homesteading. Actually, Ben has written a lot of great books. The most relevant one would be Homegrown, Adventures in Parenting Off the Beaten Path, Unschooling and Reconnecting with the Natural World. Nicole Apalian, we came so, so close to having an interview with her, but we just were not able to make the times work. She spent a lot of time with the San Bushmen in Southern Africa. She was on the show Alone in 2 seasons, I think. She's also a herbalist. She has a lot of herbal remedies for living with autoimmune diseases. Ken Robinson, sadly he is no longer alive, but it was his excellent TED Talks that helped encourage me towards homeschooling. And he also wrote a few books. Wim Hof, also known as the Iceman, for all things related to thermogenesis. Erwin LaCour, I have his momentous book, The Practice of Natural Movement. He's the founder of MoveNet. Izzy, he is a New Zealander, a homeschooling, unschooling father. He has a blog and a podcast titled Stark Raving Dad. Jenny Urick, she is the founder of 1000 Hours Outside. Angela Henscombe, she's the author of Balanced and Barefoot. John Holt, he died before I was even born, but he wrote some excellent books related to learning and education. John Taylor Gatto, he came up in my interview with Peter Michael Bauer. John is also dead, but his books, also relating to learning and education and the entire school system, still live on. I deliberately never did an interview on vaccines, but if that is something you would like to learn more about, I highly recommend the book Dissolving Illusions by Suzanne Humphreys. Also, Vaccines, Are They Safe and Effective by Neil Z. Miller. And Leslie Manoukian, I don't think she has written any books related to vaccines, but I would have loved to have interviewed her if I did. Miriam Kalamian, she wrote a book called Keto and Cancer, so that pretty much sums up what we would have talked about. Robtal Niajai Paley, she's from Liberia, and we would have talked about decolonization. Allegra Ali, she's from Israel. She's a visual ethnographer. Basically, she's a photographer who spent a lot of time with indigenous societies, and she has a lot of experience, especially with indigenous motherhood. Gabor Mate, I really hope I pronounced that properly, but I would have talked to him about trauma. Gordon Neufeld, actually Gabor Mate and Gordon Neufeld co-wrote a book that I have, Hold On To Your Kids. It describes how peer orientation gets in the way of healthy emotional maturation. Basically, it talks about how peer orientation undermines family cohesion, interferes with healthy development, and fosters a hostile and sexualized youth culture. Also, the Indigenous Anarchist. I don't know her name. She's on Instagram. She is an unhoused single mother. She shares a lot of very valuable information related to Indigenous cultures, things related to anarchism, motherhood, homelessness. Actually, I'm going to put links to all of these people and all of their resources in the show notes. William von Hippel, he wrote a book on the evolution of Homo sapiens. John Young, John, that's spelled J-O-N, his work surrounds the art of mentoring. And I would have loved to have interviewed him on rites of passage. Matthew Walker, he has an excellent book called Why We Sleep. And he would have to be my hands down number one recommendation for anything involving adult sleep. Layla Abdelrahim on, I think one of the listeners recommended her to me, on wild children and education. Krista Whiteman on like movement and thermogenesis and hunting. Klee, spelled K-L-E-E, Benally, B-E-N-A-L-L-Y, on Indigenous Action. Also Kanahaus, K-A-N-A-H-U-S, Manuel, on Indigenous Rights, and she's also a birth keeper. Adina Dort on colonialism. Arthur Furstenberg on electricity. Johan Hari on the effects of drugs and drug politics. In fact, he's written quite a few excellent books, Johan Hari. Janelle Howell, I highly recommend following her on Instagram. She's known as the Vagina Rehab Doctor. She's to cover anything related to the pelvic floor. She has all the answers. And I've just read out some of Sterna Suisse's posts from Instagram, so I highly recommend her, but also Catherine Winter Salary and Erin Royer Azralant. They're along the similar lines to Sterna in terms of communication with children. James Nesta on breathing. Peter Gray on education. And Lila June, Lila L-Y-L-A June. I really would have loved to have interviewed her on healing historical trauma. She's an Indigenous woman. She does have a couple of interviews out there that I listened to in preparation for an interview with her, but she was booked far too far in advance for us to make that work. Also topics on baby sign language. I never did an interview on baby sign language or on eyesight and vision and all the things that affect vision in our modern life. I didn't find anybody to interview on either of those two topics. I'll leave that in your capable hands. Now, as I wrap things up, I just really want to thank you all so much for listening to this over the years, and I really want to encourage you to continue sharing, to continue writing reviews, and to continue exploring rewilding, whether that's with these recommendations or if you have other ideas that I haven't shared here. The goal is basically to just encourage more rewilding. For me, I love that this podcast has served my purpose, and it's also served as a wonderful transition from when I first began this. My elder daughter was a newborn, and we were living off-grid in Portugal. Then we came back to New Zealand and had our time in limbo for 3 years while we were looking for land, and finally we found our new land. I've given birth to another child, and this podcast has seen me through that transition. And I hope that for you it has opened your minds to other family rewilding practices that you may not have come across otherwise. You know, rewilding looks different for everyone, and the beauty of it is that we can all be rewilding, but be at totally different stages in our journeys. There are many practices that I do not do, that I probably won't get to in this lifetime, but hopefully each subsequent generation rewilds a little bit more than the previous generation, until they're maybe finally back to a hunter-gatherer life way, or some sort of hunter-gatherer hybrid life way, whatever they can make work with how much the past and current generations have destroyed this planet through domestication and by living other life ways. You know, in light of what the readings I was just sharing from Arthur Haynes, I would love in the future my goal is to become an elder rather than an older. So I have some goals now that I've finished this podcast of studying to become a medical herbalist, also known as like a naturopath. And I'd love to open a forest school, and I'd love to become a movement specialist. And maybe further down the line, I'd love to become a doula and an IBCLC, and, you know, an internationally board certified lactation consultant and a spinning babies instructor, and to be able to put all of those different skills along with my own background already in psychology and child development together. I would love to be able to put that towards helping other people, being there in labor, in birth, and postpartum for women. But yes, to be able to help people from nutritionally, herbally, psychologically, movement-wise, and then to, yeah, also have the forest school. And I have dreams of writing books too. I'd love to at some point eventually write a book that encompasses all of this information that I've shared in this podcast. And I have a fiction series that I would love to get around to at some point, which is also based on rewilding. And that's just some of my dreams. I have other ones. I'll possibly share them on the social media, so you may be able to join along and follow that. But I'm glad that if anything happens to me, all of this will be available, so people will know exactly how I want my children to be raised. But anyway, the very first episode of this podcast was an interview I recorded with Darsha Narvaez, and I have chosen to end this podcast the same way, with a follow-up interview with Darsha Narvaez. So that will be the final one coming out with the last quarter of this flower moon. Now, my final question for me to end on is, if the entire world's knowledge was lost and I could only leave one sentence for future generations, what would it be? And my one sentence is, respect the natural wisdom of the young. Indulge all the babies. Play with all the children. Listen to all the teenagers. Treat them all as equal human beings, and all will be well with the world.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.